Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an analyst speaks with us about rising tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Even if an attempt is made now to try to cool the tempers, it may be too late.
We consider the possible easing of tensions in South Asia. President Obama plans to take charge on moving U.S. gun control forward. And we remember the contribution of Grammy Award winner singer Natalie Cole. Coming up right here on The Voice of America. Tensions have flared between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia has severed diplomatic relations with Iran after protesters stormed the Saudi embassy in Tehran. This follows Saturday's execution of 47 people by Riyadh, including prominent Shiite cleric and activist Nimr al-Nimr. In Washington, U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby warned the mass execution risks exasperating sectarian tensions. He called on regional leaders to de-escalate tensions. Middle East Institute scholar Zubar Iqbal says tensions between the two nations have simmered for a long time and there is no mechanism for a cooling down of the dispute, which he warns could lead to a fundamental instability in the region.
It becomes very important under these circumstances to try to cool the tempers on both sides, and that will require external forces coming in, because in neither of the two countries are there any domestic forces which will try to seek moderation or try to solve this problem in a peaceful fashion.
The United States is urging diplomatic engagement and called for leaders throughout the region to take affirmative steps to reduce tensions. But is that going to be enough?
No, fundamentally more. And tell you why I'm saying this. Because this has been building up for a long time in the region. And as you know very well, that the Daesh, the Islamic State's movement, actually began in retaliation to an absolutist Shia government in Iraq, and which tended to essentially marginalize the Sunnis, who are a fairly significant number and not a very small minority in that country. And that has built into increasingly a Shia-Sunni conflict. That being the case, and now the same thing happening in a place like Syria, and for that matter in Yemen. So the trouble that you see is that even if an attempt is made now to try to cool the tempers, it may be too late, because there's just too many centers of gravity now in the system where these kinds of tensions have now matured. And because they're matured, they've taken a life of their own. For that reason, simply making a statement or asking for diplomatic effort to resolve the problem doesn't work. You have to go well beyond that. And that would mean two things. One, try to resolve the strategic problems that exist in the region, which have spawned things like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and others. We may not like it. We certainly will not like it, because that doesn't fit in with the U.S. objectives and interests. But the reality is, may not be the case in the short term, but in the long term, it's in our interest to seek durable peace in the area. Otherwise, there will be problems. So for that reason, we may have to think substantially more. And that means a very clear-cut timetable, a framework to solve the underlying political and strategic problems that exist in places like Iraq and elsewhere, which will then tend to reduce the tension between the Shia and the Sunni. And when that happens, then it will be possible to reduce the tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia, remembering very well that these two countries have ascribed to themselves the right to lead the Shia or the Sunni extremists. It has to stop. The only way it can stop is if there are fundamental changes in our policy towards the region, which will allow for the legitimate interests of the various parties in the region to be accepted, recognized, and worked on.
Zubar Iqbal says Riyadh carried out the mass executions, mostly of Al-Qaeda operatives, with full knowledge of the reaction it would likely provoke. He says the executions and the reaction to them represents a further deepening of the Shiite-Sunni divide in the region that cannot be resolved from within the Middle East, but rather outside the region. Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And joining me with the details is social media reporter Olin Akasholu. Welcome, Olin.
Hi, Susan. Well, many people who are weighing in on Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr's execution are using hashtag Sheikh Nimr on Twitter. One of the ways people on social media are discussing it is by sharing political cartoons that critique Saudi Arabia's execution of the Shiite cleric and their human rights record in general. One popular cartoon was tweeted out by Brazilian freelance cartoonist Carlos Latuf from his handle at Latuf Cartoons. It shows a man representing Saudi Arabia showing up with bloody clothes to a meeting as the chair of the UN Human Rights Council. Another cartoon that's being shared a lot on Twitter shows a member of ISIS appearing ready to decapitate a prisoner alongside another image of a man representing Saudi Arabia also appearing ready to decapitate a prisoner. These are obviously meant to draw a comparison between the actions of Saudi Arabia and the Islamic State group, but people are sharing the cartoon off an article published by RT yesterday, and the article says the cartoon was posted on the official website of Iran's supreme leader. When I went to try and find it on the website, I was unable to, but Iranian leaders have weighed in from their own social media accounts.
Well, what have they been saying?
From the Twitter account at Hassan Rouhani, Iran's president yesterday tweeted, "I hereby condemn Sheikh Nimr's execution and send my condolences to his family and Muslim world. This act violates human rights and Islamic values." Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khomeini's Twitter account also sent off a string of tweets condemning the execution.
Thanks, Olin.
You bet, Susan.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The ninth of the 18 segments that will become the primary mirror for the new James Webb Space Telescope has been put into place. The new Webb Telescope is the more powerful scientific successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. Working inside the gigantic clean room at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, engineers and technicians recently used a robotic arm to install the mirror segment. Each of the hexagonal-shaped pieces measures a little over 1.3 meters across and weighs about 40 kilograms. When completely assembled, all 18 mirror segments will work together to form the telescope's large 6.5-meter primary mirror. NASA expects the installation of all mirror segments to be completed sometime in early 2016. The rocket that will carry the new space telescope into space is set for launch on October 2018 from the Guiana Space Center in French Guiana. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
India has been the object of two separate attacks, one on its own soil, the other in Afghanistan. Gunmen late Sunday tried to storm the Indian consulate in Mazar-e-Sharif. At the same time, Indian security forces ended a raid, which began Saturday, on an airbase in northern Punjab state. At least seven soldiers and all the attackers, up to six, were killed. Raghbendra Jha is director of the Australian South Asia Research Center and tells VOA's Victor Beatty he believes the attacks were coordinated and come at a time of growing momentum toward an easing of tensions between India and Pakistan and Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Now, with these twin attacks, both those processes have been sought to be derailed. One has to wait and see what will happen going forward.
Is there any doubt in your mind that these are Pakistani-based terrorists that have launched these attacks?
Well, all the evidence that I have seen seems to point towards one terrorist organization, Jaish-e-Mohammed. There are voice recordings, there are other types of messages, and some documentary evidence as well, I believe, from what I can read. So, no, I don't think that there is any doubt about that, but that doesn't mean that they are state-sponsored terrorists. They may be sponsored by fringe elements of the ISI or fringe elements of the Pakistani army. That is one serious problem when you start dealing with Pakistan, is that there is no unified central authority to talk to, and there are a number of non-state actors who have their own agenda.
Pakistan, of course, denounced these attacks. Is that going to help the process of reconciliation between these two South Asian powers?
Yes, that's a very good development that Pakistan has for the first time in the past. You know, the Bombay attacks, the attacks in Gurdaspur, they used to simply feign ignorance and say, well, there's no proof and we're not involved. But at least now they are open to the possibility
that there may be evidence that the Pakistani elements are involved, and they have expressed regret, which is a very useful sign. We are clutching at straws here, but we need to clutch at straws if this process is to move forward.
Is India losing its patience with these terrorist attacks?
Well, India has a lot of patience, as you know, over many, many years. Patience is basically conditioned on how the leadership in the two countries have responded to each other, have engaged with each other in the recent past. The evidence seems to suggest that Prime Minister Modi and Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif have a good understanding of how to move forward. So I think India will give them some more time. They have been asked to take action against this particular organization, Jaish-e-Mohammed, which is supposed to have sponsored these attacks. They have been asked to take action in the next 72 hours, so we'll wait and see how that goes.
The attack on the consulate in Mazar-e-Sharif is only the latest targeting Indian interests in Afghanistan. Its consulate in Herat was attacked in May 2014, preceded by deadly attacks on the Indian consulate in Jalalabad in 2013 and attacks on the Indian embassy in Kabul in 2008 and 2009. Raghbendra Jha says he fears India, which supports the anti-Taliban government in Kabul, faces a proxy war with Pakistan in Afghanistan, and that could be enough to derail New Delhi's diplomatic overtures toward Islamabad. Coming up on International Edition, controversy over a White House move on gun control and a musical tribute to an unforgettable singer. U.S. President Barack Obama has returned to Washington from his holiday vacation, looking immediately to impose new controls on gun sales. Mr. Obama, his wife Michelle, and their two daughters departed the U.S. Pacific state of Hawaii late Saturday night after their annual two-week Christmas vacation in the president's home state. He plans to meet with Attorney General Loretta Lynch today to discuss an impending executive order aimed at expanding background checks on gun sales. And he is planning a televised town hall discussion of his gun control mandates on Thursday, just days before he delivers his final State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress on January 12th. Senate correspondent Michael Bowman spoke with VOA's Jim Stevenson about the issue.
President Obama has returned from his Hawaii holiday vacation. And even before Air Force One arrived back at Andrews Air Force Base, word had come out that the president is preparing to announce executive action on a whole new front. He's already taken executive action when it comes to immigration, and now he's going to tackle a topic that is equally politically explosive, if not more so, and that is gun control.
This has been a very tough topic and thorny, as you mentioned, for several reasons, mostly because of the string of mass shootings that have happened over the last several years and the calls by members of Congress and the public at large for something to be done.
Right. And therein lies the rub. The question is whether the something that should be done should simply be to provide greater health treatment for those with mental illness, or whether we actually need to do something about the access that citizens have to firearms and the ease of that access, and to what extent the government needs to be vigilant and needs to weed out those who may have some history of doing violence. This would be the background checks. And there are background checks in place for most gun purchases, but there are loopholes. There are gun shows around the country. And people can go to these gun shows and buy almost any firearm that they want without going through the background check. And it's been pointed out that even these background checks do not screen for things that in the year 2016 maybe should be screened for, such as those who are on the terrorist watch list. So there's been an argument that these laws need to be strengthened, that loopholes need to be closed. The problem is that Congress has shown no ability whatsoever to address this in any concrete fashion, much the way that Congress has been unable to address immigration reform. This is yet another occasion when President Obama seems to be on the verge of taking matters into his own hands. One can only imagine the fight that this is going to bring about at the start of an election year.
And of course, in this country, it's important to note that there are so many dynamics in play in all of these issues. You have lobbyists going for all sorts of different angles, trying to convince lawmakers to cast their votes one way or another. You have states' rights and the power of the states to create their own laws, or the federal government to impose a law that covers the entire land. And then the Constitution also comes into play, especially with gun control, as a lot of people who advocate the right to own firearms go right to the Second Amendment.
Absolutely. The Second Amendment is here to stay. That's not going anywhere. And it's up to the courts ultimately to look at whatever President Obama does and decide, because there absolutely will be court challenges to this, just as there are court challenges to the immigration-related executive orders. There will be court challenges to this, and it will be up to the federal judiciary, perhaps all the way up to the Supreme Court, ultimately, to decide whether what President Obama wants to do in terms of his own powers, whether he is entitled to do so as a matter of executive privilege, and whether he's entitled to do so as a matter of constitutional law.
Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. President Obama is entering the last year of his presidency, set to leave office in January 2017 after 8 years in the White House. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Grammy Award-winning singer Natalie Cole, the daughter of jazz legend Nat King Cole, is dead at the age of 65. International Edition's Steve Norman looks back at her life and career.
Unforgettable, the near or far.
Like a song of love that clings to me, how the thought of you does things.
Unforgettable, written by Irving Gordon, was recorded by Nat King Cole in 1951, the year after his daughter Natalie was born. It was a huge hit for Nat, and an even bigger hit when Natalie Cole recorded a virtual duet of the song with her father in 1991, 26 years after he died.
And forevermore.
And forevermore.
A statement from the Cole family said Natalie died Thursday at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles from ongoing health issues. The statement said Cole fought a fierce, courageous battle, dying how she lived, with dignity, strength, and honor. In quoting her most identifiable song, the family also said, "Our beloved mother and sister will be greatly missed and remain unforgettable in our hearts forever."
waited for. This will be the first time anyone has loved me. Oh, I'm so glad he found me in time, and I'm so glad that he rectified my mind. This will be an everlasting love for me.
Natalie rose to musical success in the mid-1970s as a rhythm and blues artist with hits like This Will Be.
Just how much you care. You've given me the thrill of a lifetime and made me believe you've got more thrills to spare. Oh, this will be an everlasting love. Oh, yes, it will now.
Even with her success in R&B and pop music, Natalie Cole's career always remained wrapped around her father's. Nat King Cole died in 1965 when Natalie was away at boarding school. The two were very close, and throughout her career, Natalie Cole paid tribute to her father by creating virtual duets like When I Fall in Love.
And the moment I can feel that, you feel that way too, is when I fall.
It will be forever, or I'll never fall in love.
In a restless world like this is, love is ended before it's begun. And too many moonlight kisses seem to cool in the warmth of the sun.
Thanks for that tribute from International Edition's Steve Norman. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States on December 19th expressed disappointment in the process followed by the government of Rwanda to call a referendum on short notice to amend the Rwandan constitution. Among the amendments considered were those introducing exceptions to presidential term limits. In a statement released December 19th, National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price said, "While we commend the people of Rwanda for peacefully exercising their civic rights, we regret that the arrangements for the referendum failed to provide sufficient time and opportunity for political debate on the merits of the proposed provisions." The United States continues to be concerned by long-standing restrictions on peaceful assembly, association, and free expression in Rwanda. The U.S. urges the government of Rwanda to enable the full and unfettered exercise of these fundamental freedoms as the country moves toward local elections in 2016, presidential elections in 2017, and parliamentary elections in 2018. The peaceful transfer of power from one leader to another is the hallmark of stable, prosperous democracies. President Kagame, who in many ways has strengthened and developed Rwanda, now has an historic opportunity to enshrine his legacy by honoring his commitments to respect the term limits set when he entered office. By doing so, President Kagame would help to more firmly establish a credible foundation for long-term democracy in Rwanda, reinforce the substantial progress that has been achieved towards sustained peace and prosperity for all Rwandans, and set a laudable example not only for Rwanda, but for the region and the world. As U.S. President Obama has stated, great leaders throughout history forged a lasting legacy not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully. The United States remains committed to supporting the people of Rwanda in their effort to ensure a strong, stable, democratic, and prosperous future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.